So I'm going to salvation for sure.
Okay. Philosophy chapter number 19. Remember, we're still on, we started last week, philosophy of religion. We dealt with the issue of faith and reason last week. And, we're on actually chapter 18, I should say. But last week we dealt with chapter 17 on faith and reason. And so we're on chapter 18. And this is lecture number 13. I looked it over. I don't think we're going to get more than, if we're lucky, chapter 18 in this lecture and chapter 19 in the next lecture. And so now, what is meant by God, chapter 18, five different ways. Again, for the most part, I'll be just teaching right from the textbook. It's real good. The next chapter, chapter 19, I'm going to go off a little bit on my own tangent. The philosophy of religion course that we're going to have after this introduction to philosophy course will go into much more detail on the same topics here. Five ways to view God. Now, again, atheism is the view that there is no God. And agnosticism make it out of Gnosticism. In its hard form, it says man cannot know God. In its soft form, man does not know God, or man does not know if God exists. But it leaves the possibility open. And then skepticism, we should just suspend judgment on whether God exists or not. Those are outside there, but the five views about God, this is assuming that God does exist. These people either assume or believe that God exists. There is theism. We as Christians are theists. We're Christian theists. We'll talk about that a little. There's deism. There is pantheism. There's panentheism. Panentheism. And then there's finite godism. Finite godism. Now, finite godism, having a belief in a limited God, there's different types. There's three different subcategories there. There's finite, believing in a limited, not an all-powerful God, but a limited finite God. So finite monotheism, only one God, but he's limited. Rabbi Harold Kushner holds to that type of finite godism. But then there's also polytheism, the belief that there are many gods, and each one is sovereign in his own sphere. Many limited gods. None are all powerful, but each has its own control of power and all. But then there's also henotheism. Henotheism, that's polytheism, except one god is supreme above the other lesser gods. Okay? Now,
is that supreme god's limit still?
Still limited, yeah. In fact, that'd be the only difference between the health, wealth, and prosperity movement that says we're today, that says we're gods with a small g, and that we're lesser gods, and God the triune God is the big God with the big G. Well, the only difference between that and henotheism is that henotheism, even the God on the top, is still limited. So really just five views of God. Now, by the way, these views of God could be called world views. If we refer to them as worldviews, then you could also add atheism, agnosticism, and skepticism in there, because that's views about reality that do not hold to belief in God. Now we're talking about views of God, so they're kind of kept a little separate there. But keep those in mind. Let me give you a few definitions of these. Theism has a God who is both beyond and in the world. God is both beyond and in the world. Okay? We'll get into further detail on that in just a minute. Deism, God is beyond the world, but not in it. Deism, God is beyond the world, but not in it. Pantheism, God is in the world, but not beyond it. God is in the world, but not beyond it. Now, if God is in the world, but he's not beyond it, then God is the world. See what I'm saying? If he's in the world, but he's not beyond it, beyond it means to be separate from and also greater than the world. But if God is in the world, but he's not separate than it, then in that view, pantheism, God is the world. We'll get to that when we get to each one separately. Panentheism holds the view that the universe is God's body. God is the soul of the universe, and the universe is God's body.
How is that really different from pantheism?
Pantheism, God is the universe. So God is this table, God is this chair, God is you, God is me. In panentheism, the table isn't God, but the table is God's body. And the physical universe is God's body, but it's not God. Whereas in pantheism, you can call that pulpit God, your God, a spotted owl is God.
So where is God if it's just a body?
What's that?
Where's the rest of God if it's just a body of material?
Well, we'll get into the view. We'll see the differences as we come up with it. It's a bipolar God. God has two poles to him, an actual pole and a potential pole, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. There's a lot of brilliant men. One of the signs of brilliance is that a guy can take a bogus view and make it sound washable and have thousands of people holding his view. But usually when you get to like one of the basic assumptions of those views, it's just out to lunch. And finite godism, there's a limited God who's beyond the universe, a limited God. He's either not all-powerful or not all-good. He's limited some way. We already discussed the different types of finite godism. Finite monotheism, only one limited God. Henotheism, many limited gods, but one is supreme. And polytheism, many limited gods. Also, I mentioned already, atheism is the belief that God does not exist. Atheism, the belief God does not exist. Agnosticism, the harder form, says man cannot know God. Man cannot know God. The softer form, man does not know God. But leaves open the possibility that maybe we could know God some way. And skepticism teaches that we should just suspend judgment about God. So let's take a look at these five views. Theism is common to Judaism. They believe in a Jews believe in a theistic God. Christianity and Islam. Common to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. When we say that God is beyond the universe, that's called transcendence. God is transcendent. Okay? Transcendent. He transcends the universe. He's beyond the universe. He's separate from the universe. But God is also immanent. He is immanent. In other words, He is involved with the universe. That's what we mean when we say God is in the universe. He's involved with the universe. God being immanent in the universe speaks of two things. It speaks of God as the... He's directly involved with the universe. Not only did He just create us and just leave us alone, but He has to sustain us in existence. If He was the cause for the beginning of our existence, He is also then the cause for keeping us and sustaining us in existence. By the way, that's the difference between Aquinas' arguments for God's existence and St. Bonaventure's arguments for God's existence. Aquinas argues for God as the sustaining cause of our existence. Bonaventure argued for God as the cause of the beginning of our existence. Yeah, the cause of our origin. And both are right. God is definitely the cause of both. Common to theistic worldviews is that God is a...
Did you say there were two...
Oh, yeah, yeah. The other thing is that God can perform miracles if He chooses. He not only sustains the universe, but He can perform miracles. God can get involved with the universe. He's not a removed God, an absentee God. He didn't evacuate the throne after He created the universe, got bored, now He's doing something else somewhere else. But then it's possible for Him to be some other place. I think all right. God is also a personal God in theistic worldviews. He's not like a tree or a force, an electrical force that you... He's a personal being that you can have a love relationship with. Okay? Or He's a personal being that can make moral commands. He can say, thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt love one another. An electrical force doesn't command us to do anything. An electrical force could not write a book. But God is a personal God. He can write a book. He can communicate to man. Common to theism is the view that God created the universe out of nothing. God created the universe out of nothing. Also, God is a necessary being. God is a necessary being. In other words, He cannot not be. He must exist. Necessary being is a being, a totally independent being. He depends on nothing else for His existence. There's no factor that if you took that factor away, God would go out of existence. Okay? Whereas all other beings are contingent or dependent beings. It is possible that they not exist. If you take oxygen out of the Earth's atmosphere, we would cease to exist. By the way, it's all the assumption. We're arguing as like contingent beings and stuff. We're not saying, obviously, if we couldn't breathe, we would physically die, but our spirits would live on either in a state of union with God, with fellowship with God, or a place of torment. But that's besides that. That's to be proven later. And but our existence is definitely contingent upon God. But God alone is a necessary being. And God can, as we mentioned earlier, perform miracles. The big problem with deism, which is the next view we're going to look at, is that the deist says that because of the natural laws, like the law of gravity and all, and the first and second law of thermodynamics and things like that, because of natural laws, the laws of nature, miracles cannot occur. Because miracles are violations of the laws of nature. But the theist argues God can perform miracles. Natural laws are descriptive of the way nature usually acts. They are not prescriptive of how nature must act. So that's important. Natural laws are descriptive. It's man observes the nature, the normal way nature operates, and the natural laws describe how nature usually operates. It doesn't prescribe how nature must operate. So if the law of gravity says that humans stay on the ground, their feet stay on the ground most of the time, That doesn't mean that therefore Christ's ascension into heaven must be a fairy tale. The natural laws are descriptive, not prescriptive.
Well, now, even though the laws of thermodynamics, they admit, scientists will admit that it's based on extreme probability. I mean, the fact that you put an ice cube in hot coffee, the ice cube will melt. It's statistically possible, not likely, but possible that the ice cube will get colder and the coffee will get hotter.
Yeah, right. But all science is based on probability. And that's one of the things that is really so shocking, is that science has been used as supposedly a tool that's supposed to disprove God, when in actuality, science is very tentative. And a scientifically good theory
might not be true.
Might not even be true. Yeah. And a lot of good scientific theories have been supposedly proven false later on. I mean, look at, nobody would argue that Newton was a bad scientist and didn't accomplish everything, but a lot of what he accomplished has been is outmoded now. It's been shown that we needed a
so simplistic.
Yeah, we needed a better explanation of things. Newtonian physics being replaced. Atheistic objections to the God of Theism. They're mentioned on pages 273 to 275. There's the argument that God is impossible. Now, we're going to get more into atheism in the next chapter, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But there's the argument that an all-powerful being, that to prove atheism, you've got to prove God is impossible, because the atheist view is that God definitely does not exist. So they try to prove God is impossible. And the argument, in fact, look at 273. Down at the bottom it says, if God were really all-powerful, I'm reading from Introduction to Philosophy, A Christian Perspective by Geisler and Feinberg. If God were really all-powerful, then he would make a stone. Then he could make a stone so heavy that he could not lift it. But if he could not lift it, then he would not be all-powerful. Hence, no such God can exist. Okay? So there's several objections to this that Geisler and Feinberg bring up. First off, some theists argue that God cannot do something which is impossible by definition. What these guys are saying is that God is all powerful. If God can do anything, then he can get himself in a situation where he can't do it. You know, it's like a double negative. If God can do all things, then he can not do something. They're saying he can not do something. Some would argue along that the use of the double negative. If God cannot make a stone that he cannot lift, then he is not omnipotent. And so when you put that into a logical notation, it would read, any stone which God can make, he can lift. And worded this way, it doesn't present any problem with God's power. Second atheistic objection is that God, by the way, here's another way to argue against that. We need to redefine all power. Being all-powerful means God can do anything that is logically possible, which means there's some things that are not possible for even God to do, such as create things that are impossible by definition. For instance, God cannot create God. Square circles, right? He can't create God. God can't create a man who is a non-man. Things like that. So God cannot do what is impossible by definition.
The only question was, I was going to say, there's a point between, the point is that they're confusing what's humanly impossible and what's actually impossible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and exactly, because Jesus says all things are possible with God, but he's talking, and what he's basically saying that they're, what he basically means is all possible things are possible with God. But if a thing is an impossible thing, it's nonsense. Like, can God create a square circle? Can God create, God's all powerful, and he created God more powerful than him? Those are all nonsense statements. They're just totally ludicrous. There are some things God can't do. The Bible says God cannot lie. He cannot do things that are contrary to his good nature. He cannot lie. He cannot change his mind because he doesn't make mistakes. So he doesn't need to change his mind. He can't hate. So there's no problem. All that all-powerful means is that God can accomplish anything he sets out to accomplish. God can never fail. But to be able to create a stone that you can't lift is to fail. So they're saying if God is all-powerful, he can do everything, including fail. No, God is all-powerful. The only thing he can't do is fail or do the impossible, which is just pure nonsense. Second atheist objection is that God by nature must be self-caused, which is impossible. See, for something to be self-caused, it must pre-exist its own existence in order to cause itself to come into existence. And that's obviously false. But the thing is, the Christian never, no well-informed Christian argues that God is self-caused. God is not self-caused. God is uncaused. He had no beginning and no end. Therefore, God is not self-caused. He is uncaused. When Thomas Aquinas and the ancient philosophers said, or the Christian medieval Christian philosophers, when they say God is a self-existent being, they didn't mean a self-caused being. They meant God exists by his own power. In other words, he is uncaused. There is no cause for his existence. He didn't cause himself to exist, but you don't have to go anywhere else other than God to find a reason why he exists. God is his own reason why he exists, and that reason is he is an eternal being who is uncaused and has no beginning and no end. So a self-existent being doesn't mean a self-caused being, it means an uncaused being. The Christian doesn't argue, the principle of causality is not that everything needs a cause, because then it would be fallacious, because even God would need a cause. The Christian argues everything that has a beginning needs a cause, or every finite, contingent, dependent being needs a cause, but an independent, necessary, non-contingent being, or an eternal being, would not need a cause. He would exist uncaused. Yeah, cannot have a cause, exactly. So the response there is God is not a self-caused being, he's an uncaused being. Then there's the argument that evil is incompatible with God, the atheistic argument. Look at the bottom of page 274. It says, number one, if God is all-powerful, he could destroy evil. If God is all-good, he would destroy evil. But evil exists. Therefore, there is no such God. Okay? So you guys follow that, right? Several problems with this. One, they mentioned that premise three, but evil still exists, places an unjustified time limit on God.
That's true.
It's going to be. The fact is, what is the Bible? Atheists act like the Bible is the problem of evil is a problem for Christians. No, it isn't. The whole reason why the Bible was written was to solve the problem of evil. Was the fact that if we didn't fall in the garden, if there wasn't such a thing as sin and evil, then we wouldn't need a Savior. It places an unnecessary time limit on God. God is in the process of defeating evil through the death of Christ, his resurrection, and his return to earth. New heavens and new earth would be the total defeat of evil. It assumes that God has not done anything yet to solve the problem of evil, nor will he ever do anything to get rid of it. So the theist could just argue that God will yet defeat evil in the future. And Geisler points to Revelation chapters 20 to 22, and you could point to the whole Bible, in fact, the death of Christ on the cross.
Is there a second part of this?
Well, secondly, they say, it may be also that God cannot destroy evil without destroying freedom. God gave man free will. He didn't make us robots. But that entails the possibility of us freely choosing to do evil. And that if God were just to destroy, not allow evil, the only way to guarantee it possibly would be if he didn't make us free. There's also another response. I don't know if they listed here. They probably mentioned it later on. Another good response to the problem of evil is the fact that a good God, an all good God, an all powerful God would allow evil for the purpose of a greater good. For instance, courage is a good thing, but there'd be no such thing as courage if there wasn't evil in the world for men to fear. Loving our enemies, it takes a greater love than loving our friends, but we would have no enemies if there was no evil. We'd all be friends. And so here's an answer to the problem of evil that Geisler and Feinberg give. Since God is all good, he has the will to defeat evil. It's on page 275. Since God is all good, he has the will to defeat evil. Since God is all powerful, he has the power to defeat evil. Evil is not yet defeated. Therefore, evil will one day be defeated. Now, one of the things about the problem of evil is that the atheist, number one, only the Christian, when you really look at the other world's religions, only the Christian really has an answer to the problem of evil. Only the Christian God is powerful enough to guarantee that evil will be defeated. Now, the atheist uses evil. Well, what's his solution to the problem? His solution, not just the problem of evil, to evil itself. If he's going to admit evil exists, what guarantee does he have that it's ever going to be defeated? All his hopes are a bunch of pipe dreams that are going to end in the extinction of the universe. Yeah. So you see, there is no guarantee. There's no guarantee that the evil...
In fact, in the atheist system, evil wins because it's pretty evil for the whole universe to just go away and get ready to end.
And here's the other thing is, the atheist on Monday will use evil to try to disprove God. But on Tuesday, he will claim there's no such thing as right and wrong. There's no such thing as evil. So you can't have it both ways. C.S. Lewis realized when he became a Christian, he had been an atheist, that was one of the big fallacies that he had lived under. But, you know, they want evil when they want to try to disprove God, but then they don't want evil when you try to tell them what they're doing is wrong. Another thing, too, is, what was the other thing? There's something else.
Other religions solve evil by letting their God ignore it.
Or making an illusion
with the God.
Yeah, you could have two gods, a good God and an evil God. There was something else that I wanted to mention about atheists. Oh, C.S. Lewis, it finally dawned on me, the only definition that really does justice to evil is if evil is a perversion of that which is good. So the only way you could have objective evil would be if there was some objective ultimate good that the evil was a perversion of. In other words, the only way you could possibly have evil was if the ultimate good being existed, i.e. God.
Could be made mockery.
Okay, so let's take a look at deism. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. He had the Thomas Jefferson Bible where he cut out all the miracles out of the New Testament. But it's the view that God is transcendent. He is beyond the universe, and he created the universe. But he does not intervene now. So God is not imminent. He's not involved with the universe. He's transcendent. He's beyond the universe, but he doesn't get involved with the universe any longer. So God does not perform miracles. Soft deism says God does not perform miracles. Hard deism says God cannot perform miracles. He set certain laws in motion that even he can't work against. The health, wealth, and prosperity movement, by the way, has, to a certain degree, a deistic concept about God. God has set certain laws of faith and all into motion, that if you name and claim something, God can't even stop that law from bringing about what you've named and claimed, as long as you believe it. And so they basically... God is subjected to his own laws, and that is not the case. God sits enthroned. If he asks for things in accordance with his will, he gives them to us. Sometimes he gives us things that it isn't part of his perfect will for us, just sort of blow up in our face and we'll learn our lesson the hard way. Evaluation of deism. Deism denies miracles, but it affirms creation, which is probably the greatest miracle ever. You know, if God created the universe, he had the power to create the universe, number one, It would seem that he would have the power to perform miracles in the universe if he chose to. And if he desired to create the universe, then there'd probably be some pretty good argument that he would probably desire to intervene and perform miracles to make himself known. I mean, why create this universe and then say, I'm just going to go my own way and not spend any time with it?
What's the deistic view of Christ?
Deistic view of Christ is the Thomas Jefferson view of Christ. He's the greatest moral teacher who ever lived.
So they don't believe the resurrection.
They don't believe Jesus is God. They don't believe in the resurrection. And I read a lot of the personal letters of Thomas Jefferson that he wrote back and forth with John Adams. John Adams was trying to lead him to Christ. And he became closer to John Adams' views right before he died, so I'm hoping that he eventually accepted Christ. He and John Adams, by the way, both died on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of signing the Declaration of Independence. They were supposed to both speak that day, and John Quincy Adams was the president at that time, had to get up and talk about the fact that he announced that both his father and Thomas Jefferson had both died on the 50th anniversary.
His grandfather.
What's that?
Grandfather.
Oh, was he his grandfather? Because I know that Samuel Adams was the father of John Adams.
The two Adams who were presidents were grandfather and grandson.
Oh, really? I thought they were father and son. Because there was even Samuel Adams was with, like, beer manufacturer, the Boston Tea Party and all that stuff. He was the father of John Adams.
I think he was the son of John Adams.
What?
I think he was the son, and then John Quincy was the next one.
I'll look into that, because I thought it was the other way around. I thought Samuel Adams was older than John. Okay, that's deism. Pantheism. Different types of pantheism. I'm just going to run through these. You can copy my notes later. Well, you don't have to copy my notes. It's all in the book. Pantheism. Several types of pantheism. All of them are monistic. In other words, reality is ultimately one being. Okay? There's absolute pantheism of Parmenides. Remember what he says, there's only being and non-being, there's nothing else. All being is univocal. It's all the same. So absolute pantheism of Parmenides taught that all things are one. All diversity is therefore just an illusion. There's only being and non-being. And so everything that looks like more than one being is just an illusion. Then there's emanational pantheism of Plotinus. He taught that all multiplicity unfolds from the one, but God is beyond himself, beyond, God is not being, God is beyond all being. So it's more of a mystical type view, and everything else unfolds or emanates from the one. But God alone is ultimately real. In fact, God is even beyond real. He's beyond all being. Multi-level pantheism, which is common in certain types of Hinduism. Brahman is the highest level of reality. It is beyond all multiplicity and materiality. Brahman is the one, but Brahman is manifested on lower levels. The world, in this view of Hinduism, is not total illusion, but it is the lowest degree of reality. It is not quite as real as the one. When he goes up into one, the Brahman, that's the ultimate in realness. Modal pantheism, Spinoza held that. He held, Benedict Spinoza, he held that only one absolute substance exists in the universe, and everything else is only a mode or a moment of it. It'd be kind of like if we were like cells, like what cells are to our body, that's what we would be to God's body. Spinoza, by the way, was a pantheist. Although we're talking about pantheism, it's pretty obvious. There's some other time when I mention Spinoza somewhere in these lectures where I have to mention he's a pantheist because, on the ontological argument, whenever we bring up Spinoza, he used the ontological argument, but he used it to supposedly prove a pantheistic God, not a God of the Bible. Then there's developmental pantheism, which Hegel held to. The absolute spirit unfolds itself through the developments of history. He was the guy that had the thesis, and then the opposite, the antithesis, and the two would merge into a synthesis, and so history is unfolding itself, and so the absolute spirit is unfolding itself in history. So five different types of pantheism, but the common elements is that God is a non-personal being. God is non-personal. He's an it or a force. He's not a personal God who can love and give us moral commands. Creation is not out of nothing. Creation is out of God. If creation is anything at all, a lot of them view it just as an illusion. If creation is anything at all, it is God creating out of himself. And he is the only real reality. Only one being exists, that's monism, and all pantheists are monists, and God is the universe, that's what we call pantheism. Now, by the way, you can be a monist and not be a pantheist. Can anybody guess how you can be a monist and not be a pantheist? If you believed that all reality was basically one, but you just chose not to call this reality, it'd be a certain type of atheist who believes that we're all part of the same being, but the same being is not worth worship. It is not a...
It just is.
It just is. It's all it is, but it isn't God. So it'd be kind of like a...
materialistic atheist.
Well, it'd be like a materialistic pantheist who isn't really a pantheist after all. A materialistic monist. And then, by the way, you don't even have to be... Then you don't even have to be. Materialist either, because the one being doesn't necessarily have to be a physical being.
That's true.
What if I view everything that exists all exists in my mind? You guys don't really exist, and I don't think I'm worthy of worship either. And there's nobody there to worship me anyway. So they don't have a monist. The common elements of pantheism: God is non-personal, creation is out of God, only one being exists, that's monism, God is the universe, that's pantheism, and evil is not real, it's an illusion.
Oh, really?
Okay, and that's like Francis Schaeffer arguing with a Hinduist, one of the students, it was an argument with college students, and one of the students recognized what Schaeffer was saying. When Schaeffer said, in your worldview, there's no difference between cruelty and non-cruelty. And the guy said, you're right. And then another student took a hot boiling water that they were making for tea and stood up on a chair and got ready to pour it on the head of the student. And the student moved away and then realized that what he had just said, he could not condemn the action, so he just walked out into the night rather than admit that he needed a change in his worldview. An evaluation of pantheism. Pantheists must trust their senses just like everyone else. Our senses tell us that reality is many. Throw a baseball at or just scream heads up when a baseball goes flying towards a pantheist and he ducks like everybody else does. Also, Parmenides pantheism, absolute pantheism, assumes that being must be understood univocally, in a univocal sense. And it means that everything is understood in entirely the same sense, rather than analogically, where everything, being could be understood in a similar sense, such as one infinite being and many finite beings. So it assumes being is all the same. It doesn't prove being is all the same. Parmenides. Also, no one lives like evil is an illusion. You wrong somebody, they'll let you know that you wronged them. And also, if creation is God, then how could God be necessary while creation is contingent? Doesn't seem to make much sense. Some pantheists, absolute pantheists, would just say creation is just an illusion. Panentheism. This is also called, by the way, process theology. Real big heresy in the church today. Process theology, panentheism. Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne are two leaders of this movement.
This is
the view that the universe is God's body.
This Christian Science.
No, no, this is a lot different than that. It's real sophisticated. The Christian Scientists are mostly flakes. These are some real smart guys, but they got some weird views. But God, Christian Science is actually a form of pantheism. Because we are all really, it's blending of Hinduism and Christianity, and evil, sin, even the material universe is all an illusion. And we are actually all part of God.
Which religion is it? I hate to say it. Which one is it that says that we're all thetans, alien species?
That's the Scientology, Dianetics, L. Ron Hubbard. Okay, pantheism, process theology, says the universe is God's body. God has two poles, a potential pole and an actual pole. God's potential pole is eternal and infinite. Eternal and infinite. But God's actual pole is changing and finite. The actual pole is God's body. Now we're going to see that presents a big problem a little later. But panentheism is a type of finite godism. But there's enough differences for us to separate the two. But it is a type of finite godism. God and the world are viewed as interdependent. They need each other. Whereas the Christian God doesn't need the world. He created it because he wanted to. The God and the world are interdependent. They need each other in process theology. The world is progressively getting better, according to their view. Creation is a continual process of forming pre-existing matter. God is not the creator, he's the director of world processes, of the world process. So God didn't create, he just formed out of pre-existing matter. The matter was always there. Panentheists reject the unchanging God of theism as not being personal enough. In fact, they say that it's a hangover from ancient Greek philosophy, this unchanging God. Well, sure, certain Greeks said that there's got to be an unchanging being. But the other side of that coin were people like Heraclitus, who said that everything is changing except change itself. And so, in other words, no matter whether you hold to this, the ultimately real is change, or the ultimately real is an unchanging being, you got to grab either one horn of the dilemma or the other. So, yeah, we hold a view that's common to Greek philosophers in that area, but they, by choosing the other side, hold the other Greek view. So, so both views. The question isn't did you get do you have a view that's common with the Greeks? The question is which view is true. Panentheists, they reject the unchanging God of theism as not being personal enough. And that an unchanging God to them just isn't personal. He's got to be a God that can that needs us like we need him. Otherwise, it's just not a real personal relationship. Valuation of panentheism, it is absurd for God to be both infinite and finite in his basic nature. Remember, Jesus is infinite and finite, but that's because he got an infinite nature and a finite nature. He always had that infinite nature, but then he added a finite nature. So is Jesus all-powerful? Yes, in his infinite nature. Is Jesus limited in his power and his knowledge? Yes, in his finite nature. But he has two natures. No contradiction there, but it is a contradiction from the view of panentheism. Also, God is no longer sovereign. He's no longer in complete control since he's also dependent on the world. He's interdependent with the world. Aristotle brought up a good point that could be used to refute them. He said that no potential can actualize itself. Aristotle said clay does not mold itself into a statue. It takes a sculpture to do it. This cup has the potential of being filled with coffee, but it won't fill itself. Potentials do not fill himself, something actual, something that actually exists, must actualize the potentiality of something else. The pantheistic God has to actualize his own potential to exist. That makes no sense whatsoever. That's why Aquinas argued there has to be a being that is pure act, that actualizes the potential of everything else to exist. Also, the world does not seem to be getting better, so the pantheists seem to be off the wall there. And God cannot, their God cannot guarantee the defeat of evil like the Christian God can. And the question comes up, why worship a finite, non-sovereign God? Now, finite Godism is very similar to Plato's Demiurgos, his, or the Demiurge, his view of a God that didn't create the universe but just formed it out of pre-existing matter. Or finite Godism is also similar to Aristotle's 47 or 55 unmoved movers. These false gods that he held to that were moving things. I think he eventually he came up, there had to be an unmoved mover even above them. But God is limited in either his power or goodness or both due to the existence of evil. Rabbi Harold Kushner, God is limited in his power. He's not perfect, he makes mistakes, and he's limited in his power. We need to forgive God. We must aid God if evil is to be defeated. That's what Rabbi Harold Kushner says. You also have to forgive God for his mistakes. Evaluation of finite Godism. By the way, that book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, was being sold at the Christian bookstore, and I tried to convince them to take it off their shelves, or to at least put a stamp in there saying it contains heretical material. Evaluation of finite Godism. A finite God is limited, is dependent, so it needs a cause. Then whatever caused all the existence of all the finite gods must be the infinite God, the Bible, the theistic God. Also, a finite God cannot guarantee the victory over evil, so why worship him? And why serve him? And also, evil does not prove a finite God. We show there's ways to prove that God is infinite, and good reasons why he would allow evil to come into being, and to come into existence for the purpose of a greater good. So that's lecture number 13 and chapter 19 of our textbook.